Okay, this week's parsha is Parshas Naso, and we'll be starting on page 752. A number of things I want to touch on today. So, page 752.
Use this book.
Okay, so this is going to be Pasuk Hey, and it's verse 5. Excuse me, 1 second. Okay, verse 5. Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe lemar. Hashem spoke to Moshe, saying, "Daber al bnei Yisrael, speak to the children of Israel, ish or isha, a man or a woman, ki yaaseh mikol chataisa adam, who commit any of the sins of man, lim o mal b'Hashem," which the art scroll translates lim o mal to mean to commit treachery against God, v'ashma nefesh ahi, and that soul will be found guilty. V'hisvadu es chatasam asher asu, they shall confess the sin that they committed, and they shall return the guilt in its principal amount, and add a fifth, and give it to whom he is indebted to. Now what's happening here is that basically someone had your money, okay? Somebody had your money, and you swore, and they, you know, accused you that you have to give them back their money, and you denied it, and not only that, you swore falsely against it. So after you admit to your wrongdoing, you've got to pay the principal. You've also got to add a fifth to it. And of course, to whom do you pay the money to? To the person that you wronged. Now, Pasuk Ches, verse 8, V'im ein lo ish goel. If this person, again, to whom you were indebted to, has no redeemer, which means right now has no relative, la'ashiva asham elav, to return the debt to him, ha'ashav amushav la'ashem la'kohen, the debt that will be returned to God will go to the Kohen, melvada la'kipurim ha'sheyachapeh ba'yalav, and this is besides for the Ram of Atonement that a person will use for atoning. So what happens here is that the person who swore falsely has to pay, has to add a fifth. If this person doesn't have a relative, means if the person died and the person has no relatives to whom to be an heir to pay to instead, where does the money go to then? The money then goes to the Kohen. That's what the Torah says. Now, and again, the person who committed this treachery, this person who basically stole and swore falsely to it, he has to bring a sacrifice as an atonement. Okay. Now, Rashi comments, Rashi on Pasuk Ches, on verse 8, asks the following question. The Pasuk says, if the man has no relative, that means there's no one to pay to as an heir, where does the money go to? It goes to the Kohen. Goes back to Hashem by giving it to the Kohen. So Rashi says, there's really no one, there should be no one, of the Jewish people who has no relative, seemingly. You know, if you don't have children, you have brothers. If you don't have brothers, there's always someone, right? There's always someone in the line. You know, it could be a very distant relative, but if that's the only one that's there, then he's there. So what are we talking about when we say a person who has no relative? Says Rashi, we're talking about the person who actually stole from a convert. A convert has no relatives. Because once a Gentile converts to be a Jew, so he starts completely anew. You know, he has no halachic connection to his biological relatives. They're not his heirs. So you could have a convert who literally has nothing, has no relatives. If he didn't have children, if he didn't marry, didn't have children, he has no relatives. So if the person that you went ahead and stole from and swore falsely against was a convert, and he has no relatives, who do you then pay the money to? The answer is you return the money to Hashem, to God, through giving it to the Kohen. Okay, so that's part here. This discussion about a person who swears falsely about money, the Torah already spoke about that. But one of the things that here the Torah is adding to that discussion is what happens if the person that you swore falsely to was a convert and he has no relatives. What happens then? You're scot-free? The answer is no. The money that you would have given to the convert now instead goes to the Kohen as Hashem's representative. So the commentary of the Sefornu here makes a very interesting point. And the point that he makes is this. Let me just find it here, get the right place. Okay. This whole discussion in Pasuk Vav in verse 6 began by talking about a man or a woman who commit treachery against Hashem. Okay, this is a very interesting word, treachery, ma'al. Usually it's a word that's used when you desecrate something holy. If you have something that was sanctified to the base of the temple, and you use it for your personal use, that's called ma'al, that's called me'il, that's called being treacherous against God. Using something that belonged to the temple, basically sanctified to God, and you take personal use from it, that's called me'ilah, that's called committing treachery. That's not what's happening here. So what exactly is the meaning here of using the word me'ilah, of using that word treachery? So the Sefornu says like this, the reason why we're using this phrase, l'mal mal ba'ashem, to commit treachery against God, k'var ba'a kabbalah, she'zenema al gezel ha'ger b'zman ha'bayis. We know that this, the Torah is talking about where you stole from a convert in the times of the temple, that in that situation you give it to the Kohen. Now, ki am the ma'goizel oisai, one who steals from a convert, mechalol shem elakov b'nei ha'ger. He is now desecrating the name of his God in the eyes of the convert, who has now come to basically bring himself under the wings of God. Therefore, the person who does this is called mayal, treachery, or desecrating the holy. Because what is he desecrating here? He's desecrating God's name. To go and to steal from a convert. The convert then, as the Sefornu says, in the eye, God's name is desecrated in the eyes of the convert who has come to bring himself under the wings of Hashem. Imagine, right? This person is a convert. He's gone through the process. It's a big process. It's a big commitment. He's committed himself to God and to the Torah. He's committed himself to the Jewish people. And now what happens to him? A Jew goes and steals from him. You know, what does that make him think? It makes him think. It makes him think that, you know, what is this Torah? What is this religion? If the people who have been there, or if the people who have lived by it and born into it, would do such a thing. So this is something that creates doubt in his mind. It actually lowers the glory, the honor of Torah. And therefore, that's called desecrating God's name. And therefore, in this case, the Torah uses the words limol ma'al ba'ashem to commit treachery against God, to desecrate God, like someone desecrates the honor of God when he uses something sanctified to the Beis HaMikdash. Here, the desecration is the desecration of God's name because of how, in the eyes of this convert, God and his people and his Torah are lowered. Because, you know, in his mind, such a thing to happen. Look, and look, here he is. He's done so much to be able to become part of the Jewish nation. And this is what happens to him. It really makes him, you know, wonder, like, what is this Torah really about? And therefore, that's called desecration of Hashem's name. Now, this is really an example of something that's really part of a general conversation of what we call Chilul Hashem, desecrating Hashem's name, or Kiddush Hashem, sanctifying Hashem's name. There is a famous Gemara in Yoma, and the Rambam brings this down, where the Rambam is talking about the mitzvah of sanctifying God's name, which we know at its highest level means that under certain circumstances, you'd give up your life so as not to disobey certain commandments, meaning depending on the situation, we'll get into it. But there are times where a person has to give up his life so as not to disobey the Torah. And that's called sanctifying God's name. But that's one end. That's one extreme. The other end is where a person's desecration of God's name or sanctifying God's name has nothing to do with giving up your life or not, but rather it has to do with how you live your life. And let me just read to you here a little bit from what the Rambam writes. Just give me one second here. Ah, here we are. Okay. Okay. The Rambam writes that there are things that are included in desecrating God's name, and what would be included in that, for example, and a very important example, is if you have a person who is great in Torah knowledge, well known for his piety or pious acts, but at the same time, people are actually not pleased with certain behavior that he displays. Even though that behavior may not be a sin, it may not be a sinful behavior, but it's a behavior that it's not appropriate for a person of that standing. What are the examples? One example is, now again, you know, it really depends on the time and place, but one example that he gives is that, let's say, a Torah scholar goes to a store to buy something, and he doesn't pay. Not that he steals it, but, he takes it on credit, okay? And the store owner comes over to him to ask for payment, comes back to him to ask for payment, and again he doesn't pay. Now, it's very possible that if he doesn't have money, he doesn't have money. But the Rambam says, in a situation where, let's say the scholar, people know he has money, he's not a needy person, but he doesn't pay right away. And when asked to pay again, he doesn't pay right away. So is that a sin? Is that a sin? Not necessarily a sin. But at the same time, it's not an appropriate behavior for someone of that stature in Torah. A person should pay up his debts as soon as possible, not push them off. And therefore, the Rambam says, if this person, basically, the seller demands payment, and he says, I'll pay you later. But he could pay. He could pay.
Do they have a place that people can go to be like an arbitrator or to help?
Well, that's not the issue here, because it's not like it's not necessarily that he's not planning on paying, he's not paying right away. And therefore, because he's not paying right away, that's considered not appropriate behavior. You know, maybe for someone else, not on that level of Torah, and not on that level of piety, of what people assume is his piety, it wouldn't be so bad. But for this person, people say this is not becoming of such a person. Or if, let's say, he, kind of hangs around with the wrong people. Again, people say, is it a sinful thing to do that? But again, it's not appropriate for a person of this stature. He has a temper. When people come to speak to him, he doesn't receive them pleasantly. All these things are things that may not fall under the exact level of sin, but if at the end of the day, people look at this person, if people expect more from this person's behavior because of who he is, he doesn't live up to it, because he's a Torah scholar and seemingly a very observant and pious person, he's not doing these other things, in their mind they say to themselves, well, if this person is a scholar of Torah, then he should be acting differently. And therefore, what it actually kind of brings up to people's minds is that, perhaps, Torah is okay with this kind of stuff. And therefore, that's called desecrating God's name. And on the other hand, says the Rambam, the person who acts, in the highest form, of the sense of what we call menschlichkeit, dealing with people properly, being extra honest and extra careful, that's a person who sanctifies God's name. So here also we have another example of where in some ways by the convert, he has expectations. As becoming a Jew, he has certain expectations of what Jews should be acting like now. They should definitely be treating him. When they don't treat him that way, that's the desecration of God's name. On the other hand, you have other examples of, let's say you have a person who's a Torah scholar, seems to be knowledgeable, very observant, does things in a pious way, but then there are other things he kind of doesn't seem to be careful about. And again, they're not sinful. They're just not the proper behavior that would be expected from someone on that stature of Torah knowledge and Torah observance. That's also called the desecration of God's name. And on the contrary, the person who lives up to his to what he should be, the person who's impeccably honest, the person who goes ahead and is a mensch, the person who goes ahead and deals with people properly, that person sanctifies God's name. Now, in this discussion, I think it's very important to point out that, you know, it's interesting that the Gemara, the Rambam, they talk about a Torah scholar, the quotations of a Torah scholar. But there are times that, whether you're a Torah scholar or not, people have expectations from us. I mean, I think people, in many ways, have expectations of Jews.
Well, do some Torah scholars be arrogant?
It's possible. They shouldn't be. Now, you've got certain situations where, you know, you don't have to be a Torah scholar, but if you're Jewish, and people see that you're Jewish, very often they have an expectation from you. Or if, let's say, you have a person, you know, or whether maybe a person who's not so knowledgeable in Judaism and sees a person who seems to be more knowledgeable and more observant, has certain expectations from them. And when you don't live up to those expectations, your attitude can't be, well, who are they? You know, big tzaddik they are, right? Are they any better? It's not the point. That's not the point. The point is that you should be acting that way, and when you're not living up to that, and people see that, that lowers the honor of Torah, it lowers the honor of God's name, because if you live with God like this, and you observe Torah like this, then how would you be acting like this?
It's not congruent.
It's not just, you know, the Torah scholar who doesn't act in a proper way, and it's not just a situation where a person does such a terrible thing to a convert. In general, there's this idea also that no matter who we are, there are people who look at us as Jews and are observant as Jews, and they have certain expectations from us. Those expectations are essentially correct, and even if they're not living up to it themselves, but there are certain expectations. If we don't live up to it, we're actually lowering the honor of the Torah and the honor of God.
If the Torah scholar is young enough to have living parents and doesn't respect doesn't show honor, is that considered under the sin category?
Clearly. Every person has to, right. Okay. Now, the next thing I want to move on to is, let's now go to page 758. Page 758. Now, actually, yeah, okay. This part of the parasha deals with the nazir. A nazir is a person who makes a vow, and the vow is a vow to be a nazir, Nazirite in English. And what that involves is the fact that he may not drink any wine or grape products when he makes this vow. He may not cut his hair. And take a look now in verse 6, Pasuk Vav. Kol yemei azirei l'Hashem, all the days that he is a nazir to God, al nefesh meis lo yavo, he cannot come upon a dead person. Lo aviv uli'imai, to his father, to his mother, lo achiv u'lachaisai, to his brother, to his sister, he shall not make himself tummy for them in their death. Ki nezer eloikav al reishoy, for the crown of God is on his head. Kol yemei nizrei, all the days of his being a nazir, kadoshu l'Hashem, he is holy to God. So this nazir actually is comparable to the Kohen Gadol, to the high priest. Because as we know, a Kohen is permitted to make himself to come into contact with the impurity of a dead body for his closest relatives, for his father, for his mother, brother, unmarried sister, son, daughter, wife. That is what a Kohen can, you know, go get come into contact with a dead body. Cemetery, same room, whatever it may be. A Kohen Gadol can't do any of those. A Nazir also cannot do any of those. The Nazir, during his period of being a Nazir, has a certain, like the verse says, has a crown on his head. This crown of abstaining is something that makes him at a higher level than a Kohen. And the question is, you know, how do we understand that? Why would a Nazir be higher than a Kohen? So I'm going to share with you two explanations. One explanation is that, you know, you're a Kohen because your father was a Kohen, right? You don't do anything to become a Kohen. You are a Kohen. You can mess yourself up from being a Kohen, but you're born a Kohen, okay? So it's the Kohen's, you know, the Kohen status, that status of Kohen that says, you know, well, you have a certain special sanctity of being a Kohen. You cannot become impure from a dead body. Where did that status come from? It came from your family. Well, if it came from your family, if that whole status came from your family, then for your family, you could so to speak, you could compromise that status, because again, if that higher status came from your family, then you should be able to compromise to honor that family. The Nazir, on the other hand, don't you do it family? Something he accepts upon himself. Because he accepts it upon himself, it has nothing to do with his family, therefore, he cannot become Tamei at all. That's one explanation given. Another explanation given is, in a similar vein, but just a little bit of a different twist, and that is that, again, the Kohen becomes a Kohen because of the fact that you know, it's his family. And that gives him a certain level of sanctity. According to the first explanation, we don't necessarily say that the Nazir is on a higher level than the Kohen. It's just that since his sanctity doesn't come through his family, therefore, he doesn't compromise his status for his family. Another way of saying it would be that, no, a Nazir is on a higher level. And because he's on a higher level, therefore, he cannot compromise his status. And what makes him at a higher level? What makes him a higher level is the fact that he chose it on his own. Because he did it on his own volition. Again, you're a Kohen because you're born a Kohen. But a Nazir did it on his own. He did it on his own volition. Because of the fact that he did it on his own, because he brought it on that higher level voluntarily, on his own, that puts him on a higher status. There's a very interesting medrash that talks about why converts are very beloved to Hashem. They're very beloved to Hashem because we received the Torah at the giving of when God gave it at Har Sinai. And our ancestors had visions of prophecy, they saw the lightning, they heard the thunder, they heard the shofar, you know, they were put in a certain status where the situation definitely influenced them to accept.
Circumcised as a baby.
But at the same time, you've got the convert who actually, you know, his ancestors didn't go through any of that, he didn't go through any of that, but he took it on his own. And therefore, the Medrash says, Chaviv and Gerim, Gerim are very beloved, because they did it all on their own. In a similar way, that's what the Nazir here did. The Nazir is going to be on a higher level than a Kohen, because he took it on himself voluntarily. Because of that, that puts him on a higher level. His level of sanctity is greater, and therefore he cannot compromise it even for his close relatives.
It causes us to have a question. Do we do that, or we don't ask questions?
I'm not sure what you're asking.
Pardon me?
I don't understand what you're asking.
In other words, if you mention something that is confusing or goes against maybe what my grandfather taught me.
Well, you can ask a quick question.
Do you want questions, or do you want them saved for the end, or not at all?
Let's try the question. We'll see how much time we can give to answer it. Which question would you like to ask?
For example, the two things I remember from my grandfather, besides teaching me about the tefillin and everything else, he says, if you're in the woods, away from civilization, you come across a dead body, you can make an exception and bury it.
That's correct. That is correct. But that's a separate discussion.
And the other thing was that a Kohen, who may not have lived properly or observed properly during his life, has a chance before his
That's not part of our discussion now. We'll have to discuss that afterwards. We'll have to discuss that. That's not part of the discussion here. We're not talking about the Kohen. Yeah.
Okay.
If we take a look on page 760, actually 762, this part again, we're continuing the discussion of the Nazir, but in this part, we're talking about, you know, when a person decides to be a Nazir, so the minimum amount of time to be a Nazir is 30 days.
Stop.
What do you mean?
You can say, I'm going to do this.
If you say, I will be a Nazir,
for 30 days.
Wait a minute. If you just say, I will be a Nazir, without setting a time, 30 days. Automatic. If you say, I want to be a Nazir for 3 months, then you're a Nazir for 3 months. But any time you accept Nazirus, you're automatic. The minimum is going to be 30 days, which means if you just say you're a Nazir without specifying a time, 30 days. Now, at the end of the 30 days, there's a...
If you say, I'll be a Nazir for 29 days, is that a valid statement? You get 30 days, or is that invalid?
I believe there's a Mishnah in Nazir about that, and I cannot tell you what the answer is right now.
The Kohen wouldn't affect the Kohen, right? Because the Kohen would not expect it.
This is not... The Kohen is separate from a Nazir.
Yeah.
Now... So at the end of whatever amount of time it took upon himself to be a Nazir, there is a whole process that he goes through. His hair is cut, there's a set of sacrifices that are brought, and after the whole offering of the sacrifices and everything involved in that service is done, then it's pretty, you know, then it's all over, right? He could drink wine, he can come into contact with a dead body, he can cut his hair. And so now let's read on page 762, Pasuk Chaf, verse 20. So the Pasuk reads, Ve'hinif oisama koyhein tenufa lefnei Hashem, koydeshu lakoyen al chazei tenufa val sheikat truma. This just talks about that the different parts of the animal that's sacrificed, the koyhein has to lift them and weigh them in different directions. Va'achar, but this is what I want to focus on. Va'achar yishta nazir yayin, and afterwards the nazir will drink wine. Okay, the Pasuk is trying to say that once the whole service is done, when the sacrifice is done, the whole service is done, then after that, the Kohen will drink wine. Now, there are those who point out this wording is very interesting. You know, the wording doesn't just sound like it's saying, well, once he brings the sacrifices and the Nazirus is over, he may drink wine. The wording is, and afterwards, Nazir will drink wine. It almost sounds like he should. It's almost like the Torah is trying to say, and after this, he will drink wine. I mean, why are we kind of pushing him to drink wine? So, to understand this, we should actually turn back a page. Take a look. Okay, take a look at verse 14 on page 760.
760?
Yep. Pasuk Yudav, verse 14. V'hikriv es karbanoi laHashem. He shall bring his sacrifice to God. Keves ben shnasai tamim echad la'ila. A lamb without blemish. A lamb within its first year, unblemished. One of those for a burnt offering. The chavsa achas ba shnasai tamima lechatas. And then a lamb, a female lamb, when it's a kid, you know, a female lamb, also again, one within its year, unblemished, lechatas for a sin offering. So this is a big question. Why is the Nazir bringing a sin offering? What sin did he do? Nazir didn't do any kind of sin. The Nazir went ahead, he took upon himself these restrictions, even it makes him holy enough that he becomes like a Kohen or better, and now he's bringing a sin offering. Why is he bringing
because
a sin offering? So one answer is because he stopped being a Nazir. That's one answer that's given, actually.
Really?
Another answer that's given is that, and this fits into also to explain why it says, why the Pasuk seemed to be pushing him to drink wine. And that is that, in essence, a person should actually, if they can, I'll put it this way, it's better for a person not to have to be a Nazir. Why does a person become a Nazir? Why does a person decide that he's going to start abstaining from wine and start kind of pulling himself away from the regular interactions and regular actions of people? Why is he doing that? And the answer is he's doing that because he feels that he needs to do something more. There's something here, you know, wine has its negative influences. he feels a little bit too either lustful or whatever it may be, and he needs to do something to pull himself back. So what does he do? He forbids himself from drinking wine, which is something that we know, wine, again, in its strongest form, has the ability to get a person going. And therefore, he is pulling himself back because, you know, he's got to kind of go to an extreme to make sure that he doesn't mess up. But really, really, Hashem wants us to partake of the world that he created for us. He wants us to experience all the benefits that he gave us. Hashem didn't create a beautiful world just to tempt us, and our job is to try to ignore it all. Hashem gave us a beautiful world to appreciate his kindness and to basically make an equilibrium between serving him and partaking from the benefits that he gave us in a way that doesn't take away from his service. Because we do know that when we become too mundane and too lustful and too pleasure-seeking, that takes us away from the service of God.
Take care of the benefits.
Right. So the goal really is to create an equilibrium where you can serve God and partake of his goodness. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, oh, so I can partake of his goodness as much as I want and still serve God. No, it doesn't work that easily. It doesn't work that way. There is the way that the Torah tells us how we should deal with our physical needs. There's much talk in the Talmud and in many other works exactly how to do it. But it doesn't mean though that a person has to abstain from everything. A person should be able to partake of the world in the proper way and serve God together. There should be an equilibrium. If a person feels that for some reason he's not in a good state. He's in a state where his desire for physical pleasure is taking him away. That's the kind of person that says, okay, I got to go to a bit of an extreme right now. I have to take myself away from even regular partaking of certain pleasures so that I will kind of, you know, bring myself back to not being so lustful for pleasures, and I'll be able to get back to the equilibrium. So the Nazir has to do something to separate. He has to do something that really, in essence, Hashem doesn't want him to do. But he's doing it for the sake of God, but he's doing something that, in essence, God would rather have him not have to do. At the same time, God, that's for sure. And therefore, he deserves a lot of credit, and he brings himself to a high level of holiness. But at the same time, it was all due to the fact that he was kind of slipping away from where he should be. Therefore, the Torah says, when he completes the Naziris, he brings a sin offering. Not because he committed a regular sin of the Torah, but to bring out this idea that in essence, what he did had a certain shortcoming to it, to a certain degree. Most people aren't going to do what he does, even when they have that shortcoming. Most people aren't going to do that, even when they feel weak. And therefore, he gets a lot of credit for that. But it's important to point out that the proper level Hashem really wants us to be is to be able to partake from the blessings of the world in a way that it's not detrimental to our spiritual level. And therefore he brings the chatas, and therefore they want to say that when the pasuk says, after brings the carbon, and afterwards another should drink wine, which sounds like he should go drink, is a way of saying that, you know, now after the nazir, you've done what you have to do to bring yourself to where you need to be. Now go and partake from Hashem's pleasures. Of course, in moderation, in the right way, at the right amount, but you should do it because Hashem didn't create these things to be ignored. He created these things for us to be able to appreciate appreciate the goodness he gave to us.
When Torah says wine, it means everything made from grape?
Okay.
Or vodka, whiskey?
No. It's only grape.
Alcoholic.
No, only grape. It's only talking about grape.
Still able to drink drink?
Yeah, because in the Torah's time, the real alcohol drink was wine. That was the potent drink. When people wanted to drink in the times of the Torah, right, and in the times of the Talmud also, schnapps was not the way to go.
But the law
is the way the Torah establishes it. So if a person were to make himself a nazir nowadays,
yeah,
he could still drink schnapps. Because the Torah never forbade schnapps.
But practically speaking,
Okay, he has to be. If he feels he needs it, he feels he needs it. But you can't say it's part of what the Torah.
I think there's a question: if somebody in our time,
he shouldn't do it.
No, it makes sense to.
No, the problem is because. What did you say? No, you shouldn't do that. You know why? Because it's pretty much impossible for us not to make ourselves impure from a dead body. Now, there had there.
What was that last sentence?
I just say it's pretty much impossible for us not to make ourselves impure from a dead body, and therefore we should not make ourselves nazir. Even though there was a person in Eretz Yisrael a number of years ago. I saw pictures of him that he was known as the nazir.
Oh, not in our time.
Yeah. So I don't know how he dealt with that question.
Rabbi Gorin's father.
Father-in-law. There was somebody, he was known as the Nazir, he had long hair. And but I don't know how he dealt with the tumah part. Unless he did the Zira Shimshin. Maybe there's a certain type of assistant Zira Shimshin, maybe. Oh. I can't remember. I don't remember what the answer to that is. But to go in and make yourself a regular Nazir, nowadays nobody does that. Can't hear you. So you won't? So you won't? You'll be the Nazir for the rest of your life?
Is it Nazir of Noel?
Okay, if he's going to be for the rest of his life.
Yeah. He'd have to be for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
I believe so. Yeah. Okay. Now, next part of the parasha is the Berachas Kohanim. You know, what we call dochening, right? We have the Berachas Kohanim. And I want to share with you an interesting thought. If you look at Pasuk Chav Vav, verse 26, which is the last, you know, the blessings of the Kohanim, it consists of three verses. Yirechacha Hashem v'yishmerecha, Yara Hashem panav elecha v'chunecha, and then we have the third Pasuk. And the third verse, which is Pasuk Chav Vav, verse 26, reads, Yisra Hashem panav elecha, Hashem, may Hashem lift his face, his countenance unto you, v'yaseim l'cha shalom. The same Lecha Shalom they translate as, just one second, right, the Yaseim Lecha Shalom, the Yaseim means, and he shall place for you peace, which they tend to interpret that as establish. The Yaseim Lecha Shalom, he will establish peace for you. Now, that's a very interesting way of talking about asking for peace. Hashem should establish peace. You know, the basic word of it, he should give you peace. What do you mean it should establish for you peace? So the explanation that I saw, the way I understand it, is that when you use the word v'yaseim to place something, to establish, you're establishing a something. There's something positive that you're making. Okay, you're not just removing something negative, you're establishing something positive. Now, very often when we talk about peace, in the context of taking away a disturbance. So, for instance, just an example that I saw. Okay, there was a teacher who had a troublesome student. The teacher was speaking to the principal, and the teacher says to the principal, "You got to get this kid out of my class." He says, "Why?" He says, "You know, he's so disruptive, and we'll finally have some peace in the class." Okay. So the principal says, if you remove him from the class, you're not going to have peace. That means you'll just won't have a headache. But if you actually work on him to become a productive part of the classroom, then you'll have peace. Real peace means harmony. Real peace means when you take things that have the potential not to get along, and then they are able to come together and to coexist together. That means there's harmony. That means when things that should contradict can work out together, that's harmony. Very often, we say peace means like, okay, just take away the headache. Okay, take away the headache. I mean, that is a certain level of peace, is no what we refer to. But real peace means that it's not just taking away the headache. It means there's harmony. That means there's different things that seem to contradict, but they come together and they work together. That's what real shalom is. So if there's someone that's annoying you, you can say, oh, just give me some peace, get him out of here. Okay? Real shalom means that you learn to coexist. You learn to work together, to be able to be together. So therefore, the pasuk says, "V'yaseim l'chashalom," he will establish for you peace, means that we're trying to make it clear that the peace that we're talking about is not just the removal of something negative, the removal of disturbance, but it means that there's harmony amongst ourselves. Not only that we don't fight, but that there's harmony, that we're actually being able to coexist and to work together and mesh together. There's a peace in which we don't fight. Okay, there's no fighting. Good. But real peace is when everything comes together, even those things that should seem to be fighting. Instead of not just fighting, they come together. That's the word, that's the real word for shalom. Shalom, peace, is related to the word shalem, which means complete.
It's the skills to bring the pupil to that point.
But that's the point is that he was just trying to point out that the word peace means something more than that. And that is what we're talking about here. V'yaseim l'cha shalom, establish peace, means that we're not just saying no fights, but rather there is harmony. That people are coming together, living together, flourishing together, even when there's differences. And those differences could, some or another, break them apart. Not only is there no acrimony, but there's harmony. They're working together. That's v'yaseim l'cha shalom, establish peace. Peace is not just taking away something negative. It's something. It's a positive. And that's what it means, and she should establish peace for you. Now, the last part of the parasha is very unique because it talks about how on the day that the Mishkan, the tabernacle, was completed, so and it was inaugurated, there were gifts that the Nesiim, each tribe had a prince, had a leader, and each prince brought a set of sacrifices. And actually, it was a whole set of sacrifices, certain animals, certain vessels, keteres, incense, all these different things. And the Torah records the gift of each one of the princes. Now, it doesn't just say 12 princes bought A, B, C, D, E, F, G, which is what they actually did. But rather, it says the first prince brought A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And the second prince brought A, B, C, D, F, G. And the third prince. We go to all 12 princes, all 12 leaders of tribes. It repeats the same thing over again 12 times. And now we know that the Torah doesn't use extra words for no reason. And it's very odd that the Torah goes through so much of repeating over and over again the same thing, which is usually out of not the norm of what the Torah does.
Emphasis.
So there are a number of explanations that are given. One explanation that's given is the fact that the Medrash points out that each one of them actually intentionally brought the same thing. Meaning, each one on their own. It's not like they got together and they said, okay, let's all bring. They didn't do that. Actually, in the beginning of the parasha, it talks about how they brought wagons and animals together. But then afterwards, each gift that they gave, each gift that the prince gave, it was all done on their own. It's not like they decided, let's all do this. Each one did it on their own. And they still came out with the exact same thing. That's because basically what they wanted to do, basically it was that the way one of the Mefarshim and the Medrash says is that they were able to do this through prophecy, through Ruach HaKodesh, that they knew what each one was bringing, and they intentionally brought the same thing. Why did they intentionally bring the same thing? The Medrash says it was an act of honor for each other. Basically, they didn't want to seem like, oh, you know, they didn't want it to give what could look like competition. They didn't want to do that. They didn't want to go ahead and either put someone else down or create some kind of a jealousy or an envy or a competition between them. It was all about, the Medrash calls it honoring each other, meaning they didn't want to possibly put down the other one, make the other person feel bad. And therefore, they all brought the same thing. So the Medrash is mentioning that each one brought the same thing because they're trying to bring out the idea that each one on their own brought. It's not like a plan of all them together to do this list. Each one on their own decided to do exactly what the other one did. And the reason they did it was because they didn't in any way want to put down the other person. Because of that, says the Medrash, something very unique took place here. If you have 12 princes over 12 days bringing their gifts, bringing their sacrifices and gifts, right? There were sacrifices they brought. One day has to be Shabbos. When it has to be Shabbos. The rule is that your own personal sacrifice you cannot bring on Shabbos. You can't slaughter an animal on Shabbos. And even if for a mitzvah of a carbon, that doesn't override Shabbos. And here, they did 12 days. We know it was 12 days straight. That means the person, I don't know exactly what day it started, but somebody brought it on Shabbos. Says the Medrash that Hashem told Moshe it's okay. Hashem basically said it's okay to bring them to bring it on Shabbos. And Hashem said, because you all gave each other honor, I will honor you that you'll be able to even to bring it on Shabbos so that there should be no interruption in between. Apparently it was a greater honor to them for being no interruption of all the gifts, meaning nobody should be basically left out. No, one day, you know, when it was his turn, but he's kind of standing out there not doing anything. And maybe that's what it means. But the point, the Medrash says that Hashem says, you showed each other honor, and therefore I will show you honor. So the reason why the Torah is mentioning each one and repeating it over and over again is because, again, it's trying to bring out the idea that each one brought it on their own. There was no plan here to do this. Each one decided to give his own gift, but each one knew, right, what the other one was going to give and decided to give the exact same thing, so as not to make anybody feel uncomfortable, not to make anybody feel bad. And because of that, Hashem honored them to allow them even to bring it on Shabbos.